Committee on Human Services.
I should have looked at you first, Pat.
And I would like to, first of all, welcome everyone and indicate that we're going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2217. Colleagues, I'm open to any discussion on this, but it's today's goal, at least, is to send this on down to Judiciary after prior consent and what is it when you talk to people? Communication with the Judiciary Committee, House Judiciary Committee. So, unless there's something we can certainly, I'd entertain any comments. Otherwise, I'm going to go ahead and entertain a motion. Any comments? Representative?
Did the trial lawyers have an opportunity to come in and weigh in on this to us?
We're going to send them over to that other committee.
Okay.
But they'll have ample opportunity.
Are we sending it without recommendation?
Yes.
We are.
With a due pass recommendation. I'm sorry, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please, Madam Chair.
With a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the committee by Judiciary by prior reference.
Why are we doing a due pass rather than without recommendation?
Ask our staff.
You can do either way. So it has prior reference to Judiciary. I didn't think there was an issue, so that's why it's due pass. But if you prefer to do it without recommendation, you can do that as well. There were no issues on the original testimony we heard on 216. So there was only two individuals that testified on this bill when it was originally heard, and both were proponents for it. So
I don't see a problem with amending that the motion if you prefer.
Well, if we're going to send it with a due pass recommendation, I think we need to have some discussion about it. So, but I mean, if we're going to send it for there to work, then let's send it without recommendation.
Why don't we just amend this? Say send it referred to the committee on Judiciary by prior reference. Right.
Let's edit that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Any problems with that, committee? Good. Then, at your convenience, Madam Chair, I will entertain a motion as suggested.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2217 to be referred to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference.
Chair Tomei moves House Bill 2217 to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Excused.
Representative Wyden.
Aye.
Vice Chair Fenwick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Excused.
Chair Tomei.
Aye.
Chair Gillen.
Aye. The motion passes, and the bill is sent to the Committee on Judiciary. You're the informal carrier since you're on the committee.
Okay.
And thank you, Representative Greenlee, for that clarification. I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2217, and I'm opening. Hold on just a second. Actually, just for everyone's information, we're going to hold over House Bill 2464. That's the only action I needed.
Can we ask if anybody is here to testify on this?
Unless there's somebody here who specifically came for that bill. Anybody? Going once? Okay. We're going to hold over 2464. That's the only indication they need to make, correct?
Correct.
And I'm now going to open a public hearing. I think we'll go to 2924 since some of our colleagues are not in the room for 2438.
Which one?
What did I say?
2928, is that what you mean?
Should we do that? So, if you'll follow along, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2928. Jennifer, would you give us the brief overview, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2928 authorizes hearings under the Family Abuse Prevention Act to be held in person or by telephone. We do have -2 amendments, which were received or which were passed along to all committee members. And basically, that amendment clarifies how the motions for testimony by telephone should be considered in contested restraining order cases. Cross-references current procedure is set out in the Oregon Revised Statute, ORS 45.400, to make clear to victims that such motions are allowed. Specifies that victim safety is to be considered in assessing whether there is a good cause, and specifies the time frames should be adjusted to allow for the expedited nature of restraining order procedures.
Thank you. And sure enough, just as we open this, if you all just hold on a second, I want to, by a nod of the head or otherwise, ask our colleague, Representative Bailey, how is your schedule? Would you like us to go back to the bill that you came for?
I can wait, Mr. Chair, for your business.
Thank you so much. I'd like to ask the three of the four that have signed up so far for this bill, 2928, Christine Herman, Aaron Greenwald, and Megan Kovacs, to please come forward.
She just gave a note.
I just got a note that I would, can I ask one of you to hold, and
sure.
Sybil Hebb is here, and she could give us some background that would help the whole context. Is that okay?
Absolutely. No problem.
Sybil, come on up and start us off, and thank you for the heads up. We appreciate it. And Sybil, go ahead.
Thank you so much, Chair Gillian, Co-Chair Tomei, and representatives. I appreciate that. And I thought it might just be helpful if I provided a little bit of the background related to this bill. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. In support of this House bill, 2928, and there are pending amendments which I think are under a little bit of further negotiation because we wanted to make sure that the defense attorneys were okay with this bill, and their commitment to me has been, and to Representative Holvey's office, who is the chief sponsor of this bill, that with the Dash 3 amendments, which are consensus, they are in support of the bill and have no concern about it. So the general concept is that in restraining order cases, in domestic violence circumstances, victims often experience escalated levels of violence after they have taken steps to leave an abusive relationship and seek the safety of the court. Sometimes there is retaliation as an effect of having taken those steps. And so the period after getting a restraining order can be an extremely dangerous one, and often victims are counseled by victim advocates and attorneys and others to take serious safety steps at that time to prevent further injury to themselves or to their children. Sometimes that requires that a victim leave the area, and often it requires that they do anything they possibly can to avoid contact in person with the person who is the abuser. So sometimes what happens is restraining order defendants ask for a hearing, and that requires the victim to come to court and face the abuser in person. And there are legitimate reasons for that. But in certain circumstances where the safety risk is so great that the victim is afraid for her physical safety and counseled against coming into any contact with the perpetrator, that puts the victim in an untenable situation in which she's forced, or he is forced, to make a decision. Do I give up this court protection that I was counseled that I needed for my further protection and for the protection of my children? Or do I take the safety risk of going to court and facing this person in person? And that's a bad situation to be in. And so the procedures related to civil proceedings already currently recognize that sometimes there is a need for a party to a case or for a witness to have permission to appear in a hearing by telephone or other two-way electronic communication. The judge, under current law, has the ability to use his or her discretion to determine what is the fair outcome and answer to a motion to request to appear by phone in a hearing. And the statute currently guides the state or the court to make a decision about what would be the prejudicial impact, if any, on the case if the person were not there in person, and what are the other good cause reasons related to why a person may need permission to appear by telephone. So this bill would not change the judge's discretion. The judge would still have the ability to make all of those determinations, but the bill would merely make it clear how the current statute related to telephone testimony would be put into place in the expedited and emergency situation related to restraining order hearings. Restraining order hearings happen on a very quick turnaround, and that's not consistent with what the current timeframes are for judges deciding motions to appear by telephone testimony. Also, the list of good cause criteria that judges are guided to consider when they're making decisions about telephone testimony does not currently include an analysis of victim safety. So the bill would merely, in the restraining order statute, make it clear that victims and any party has the right to ask for telephone testimony. The judge will use his or her discretion as currently, but there are two factors to be added to that use of discretion, and one is a consideration of victim safety, and the other is a consideration of the expedited nature of the proceedings when determining whether or not to make waivers of the timeframes. So we're very supportive from the victim services aspect of making sure that restraining order hearings are not a position in which, or don't put victims in a position in which they're at greater risk, and making sure to streamline the current telephone testimony statutes so that they are applicable and useful in the restraining order statute is of great benefit to victims. We think that it will be a good change in the current law that will accomplish victim safety while also preserving fairness and accountability. So for those reasons, we urge your support. And I have a summary of the statute, which in my haste to come up here, I forgot to give out, so I will pass that along.
Good.
Thank you.
Civil, if you'll stick with us, don't go far right there. You may be a good asset as we continue our questioning. And I'm going to ask you for your further patience, if you're all right.
Sure.
But we had hoped to get Representative Holvey on the phone, but he came in person. And I'd like to have my colleague, Paul Holvey, representative from Skinner's, glad to have you. Skinner's.
I'm not helping you.
All right, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this today. My name is Paul Holvey, for the record, State Representative from District 8, the Emerald Empire. And I really appreciate this because I have recognized some trends in the state, just watching in my own community victims of domestic violence really getting into bad situations, noticing a trend across the state of increased instances of domestic violence and also fatalities as a result of domestic violence. And I think this bill is though perhaps a minor adjustment to some of the proceedings around domestic violence that it ultimately will help reduce these instances in that victims oftentimes are very intimidated to come forward in person. And if they don't participate in these hearings, sometimes they will lose that protective order. And that lapse in protective order can then become a great danger to them in the future. So I really appreciate the work of Sybil Hebb and helping me with this issue and an opportunity perhaps for your committee to consider this bill. I've handed out some testimony with some points about this bill, which I will not read to you because I know you're all quite capable of that. I just want to express my concern about domestic violence in this state. These trends are really alarming, especially when our economy goes bad. So I hope that this is just a small thing we can do to maybe help save one person's life. It would be worthwhile. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions, but certainly I think Sybil is probably more prepared to answer the technicalities. I will address the Dash 2 amendment that is before you. We did have a conversation, and we're still trying to figure out whether or not there's one line that's necessary in the Dash 2 amendment, and it is on line 12 of the Dash 2 amendment, whether the words the safety or welfare of the party or witnesses as well as really needs to be in there, because it is in subsection 3 below in that particular sub 2 of section 2 is talking about the notice. And so I haven't got a chance to get feedback. It's not perhaps a major deal, but it was something that was brought up if it was really necessary. We're checking with legislative council right now to see that. So we will either have a dash 3 or go ahead and move forward with this dash 2. It's not a big change, doesn't change the substance of anything in the bill. It's just one of those legal technicalities. Is it really necessary? So, and this bill does still allow the courts some discretion in this whole issue. So I really appreciate the opportunity to speak and hope that you look favorably upon this bill and move it to the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. And we'll continue with the testimony. Thanks for coming. Please.
Which microphone?
Come on. You can take your seat back. Thanks very much.
Representative, co-chair, Representative Gilliam, co-chair Tomei, committee members, my name is Erin Greenewald. I'm an attorney general, assistant attorney general at the Criminal Justice Division. I'm the domestic violence resource prosecutor for the Oregon Department of Justice. That was a position that was created last March. Oregon was one of, at the time, 23 states in the nation that had such a position, and now we're a little over half the nation having such a position. Hardy Myers and then Mr. Kroger determined, along with a lot of folks, that we needed somebody who was dedicated to domestic violence, prosecution, technical assistance. I have been a prosecutor since 1999, but I've been involved as a law clerk and then as a prosecutor with domestic violence prosecution. So my entire career as a prosecutor has been spent doing domestic violence and sex abuse cases, and I'm here in support of this bill. And I would echo what Ms. Hebb and then Representative Holvey have indicated to you, which obviously there's a disturbing trend surrounding domestic violence and domestic violence fatalities. And specifically, I would echo what Ms. Hebb said about when parties separate and the increasing and escalation of violence at that particular time. When I look at this bill and restraining orders, what I see is the standard to get a restraining order is that there has to be some imminent abuse that has happened or threat of abuse that a petitioner is worried is going to happen. The statute says that that has to have happened within the last 180 days, but it's my experience that typically that abuse or imminent threat of abuse has happened within the last 24 to 48 hours. There's a reason why a person's coming in to get this protection. And what we're talking about in this bill is that there is a contested hearing that's been requested. So what that means is that a judge has already said that there is enough information or evidence to have given a restraining order out, and now that restraining order is being contested. And exactly what Ms. Hebb said, which is now we're putting a victim in the position of having to confront that abuser. And as I'm sure you are all aware, what domestic violence is really about is power and control. And a way that an abuser can exert power and control is by bringing his or her victim, the petitioner of a restraining order, into court to exert that control over them at that period of time. I actually just prosecuted a case over in an eastern county it was very, very serious. He actually just pled and went to prison for 60 months. But right after this happened, this incident happened where he used a firearm against her, she fled the state because she was so fearful, of course. Well, she had to return to the state because he requested a contested restraining order. And she was not aware, nor was the advocate helping her, that she could have requested a hearing over the phone. And so this bill, I think, is really important to add awareness for victims, for advocates, those of us helping victims, that they can appear by phone. And it's really important to clarify for judges that they can specifically take into account the victim safety aspect of these restraining orders. I am certain that had she been aware that she could appear by telephone, she would not have returned from where she was. But she felt it very important to have that continued protection in a restraining order. So she came back. And then one other thing I would add is I know that when she appeared for that restraining order, although we were able to get her legal representation actually through the Oregon Law Center, the defendant appeared, as did the defendant's family. And I've listened to the testimony. The judge actually had to admonish the defendant's family because they were making faces and obviously trying to intimidate or threaten her, which again is another reason why allowing a victim who's been placed into danger, giving them the opportunity to participate by telephone so they don't have to confront that additional intimidation is very important. So for all of those reasons and those given by Ms. Hebb and Representative Fulvey, I would support this bill, and I'm open to any questions, obviously, if you have any.
We're going to hold the questions for all three of you, and if you'd go ahead, I'd appreciate it.
Great. Hi, Chair Gilliam and Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Megan Kovacs. I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator at Raphael House of Portland. Raphael House is a domestic violence agency in Portland, Oregon, and we provide a number of services for survivors in the community. I support this bill in working with survivors over the past 5 years. One of the most imminent times of danger is when a person is leaving, as everyone who's already spoken has said. A person is more likely to be in serious threat of harm when they are leaving an abusive person. And with the survivors that I've worked with, a huge barrier to accessing services like a restraining order is the fear of confronting their abusive partner. And that is a very real fear. One of the things that we do when a person comes to shelter, when a person accesses resources at Raphael House, is to create a safety plan with them. And a huge part of that safety plan is trying to avoid their abusive partner in whatever way possible. Whether that be changing the routes that they drive to work, whether that be changing their work schedule, whether that be, moving their kids from one school to another to avoid that person. And when, a person is faced with having to see that person again, that abusive person again, it can create a barrier to actually, wanting to get a restraining order, to accessing that resource, or to accessing other resources for protection in the community. I think most notably in 2004, a survivor was actually shot by their partner on the courthouse steps. And this does create, a serious situation of danger to have to confront that person. As you said, confronting them in a courtroom can, again, exhibit those patterns of power and control that are often present in an abusive relationship.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a private, nonprofit organization that represents statewide interests in sexual assault. We have membership of about 200 Oregonians that represent different responders to sexual assault, including prosecutors, advocates, police, medical providers, educators, et cetera, as well as prevention professionals and treatment providers. The Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force is in support of House Bill 2928 with amendments that have been discussed. And I appreciate this information that Ms. Kovacs and Ms. Greenwald have both brought forward. I am a former prosecutor. I prosecuted in Washington State, and the one and only fatality in the King County Courthouse was a man who shot his estranged partner at a restraining order hearing. The danger at this time cannot be overstated. And a simple process like the ability to appear by telephone can mean the difference between life and death. And I don't mean to be overly dramatic, but we have now heard of two instances where that exactly was true. And appreciate Representative Holvey's advocacy on this bill and on this effort, and urge your support of it.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And after serving on a committee with Chair Holvey, I really appreciate him bringing this bill, because this isn't attacking someone else and working for somebody else. This is a very good bill. This might be for you, Ms. Kovacs. I'm just looking through here, and when they report by phone, it doesn't have any stipulations. So are they alone? Do we know if there's somebody there that could be telling them how to answer, things like that? And that would be the only thing that would concern me a little bit. If somebody is appearing by phone, who do they have in the room with them? And is there somebody there coaxing them on their answers possibly? And I don't know if there's anything set in statute for that, and it looks like Sybil's ready to jump all over this. So But that would be my only concern looking at this. I'm very supportive of it. I just want to make sure we're protecting everybody when we do this and do it properly, because it could be someone there in support of the person to coax them in the right direction that they need to go. It could be somebody there threatening them to say what they shouldn't be saying.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener and members of the committee, it's a good question. And the statute that we will be, that the bill would incorporate into the restraining order statute is set out in ORS 45.400. I believe that's in my materials. And it allows the court to take into consideration all of those factors and ask all of those questions. So things like, from where is the call being made, or can the court place the call so that they're assured of where the call is being accepted? And those kinds of things can be taken into consideration. And also, you know, the court may require witnesses to swear as to the circumstances surrounding their provision of testimony. The statute also applies to two-way electronic communication, which means essentially video conferencing, and that is probably a more secure and reliable means of providing testimony. So that's the norm when that's available, but the court would be able to use its discretion in making a decision about those criteria and others. This would merely incorporate the consideration of victim safety issues when they're applying their discretion to those circumstances. So I hope that answers your question.
That answers my question.
Other questions? Representative Harker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Waking up.
Truly.
Am I right to think, I think this is important, but am I right to think that it's actually not necessary that people actually right now could testify by all the means that are delivered by this bill with the dash two amendments and perhaps beyond?
Co-chairs and Representative Harker, the bill, technically victims would have the right under current law to seek to submit a motion to appear by telephone. However, ORS 45 is, most victims in restraining order cases are not represented by counsel. They may look at the restraining order statute. Often that is available in courthouse restraining order advocacy rooms. They are unlikely to know that ORS 45 exists. And so we believe that the cross-reference will be really helpful in making it clear that there is that ability, and it also provides some clarity to the judge about how to deal with the expedited nature of the hearings and the victim safety analysis. So that's our reason for supporting the bill.
And you're welcome to comment, and you too, Megan, even though we're making you play musical chairs. If you, any of the questions, you're welcome to comment as well.
Thank you.
Are there other questions?
I've got one, and it's please don't misunderstand it. It's just to the side. I understand the need for clarification and awareness, and I take very seriously the testimony. We all know that most of the victims are women and mothers. Not all, but I'm just saying that. And maybe that's just my opinion, but I believe that to be true. Can you just assure me when we're looking at this, I'm particularly thinking of children, and I don't think there is a direct effect, but these situations are always complicated, that there's no gender discrimination in the what we're trying to do in this bill, male or female.
And Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, it's a great question. There's absolutely no gender discrimination. Restraining order applications are made by men and by women, and the analysis under the statute is the same, and that's true also of the amendment and the application of the telephone testimony. And to answer your question about the percentage of children involved, 48, you're right, and 48% of victims seeking emergency shelter have minor children, one or more minor children, yes, with them at the time. So it is a big issue for parents.
Seeing no other questions, I appreciate you all coming. And I think that was a good first hearing on this bill, so thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2928. And I'd like to open a public hearing. It's our first public hearing on House Bill 2438. And I'd like to ask two colleagues of mine that I'm looking at to come forward. Yeah. I'm going to have Jennifer just give us the quick background, and then I'd like your testimony. Jennifer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2438 requires each school district to adopt age-appropriate dating violence education in the school curriculum. The policy would include grades 7 through 12. It creates permissive language for counties to use one or more of the state's domestic violence funds for prevention, which would allow them to support public and nonprofit entities that provide teen dating curriculum, as well as other prevention measures. Continuously appropriates money into the accounts to fund teen dating violence series and allows the Director of Human Services to make grants for the prevention, identification, and treatment related to teen dating violence. It commissions a long-term longitudinal study on teen dating violence in Oregon, requires collection of a fee at the time of the petition filing for marital annulment, dissolution, or separation to be paid into specified teen dating violence accounts, requires Department of Human Services Health Division to include teen dating violence questions in their annual Oregon Healthy Teens Survey. We do have a dash one amendment that has been provided to committee members as well. The effect of that committee amendment, it removes the divorce filing fee increase. It modifies the structure of the longitudinal study to establish the Teen Dating Violence Longitudinal Study Fund in the state treasury, separate from the general fund. This fund shall consist of contributions of money from any source, public and private. It amends Section 12A, Subsection 2, Subsection A, to reflect that teen dating violence is prohibited and each student has the right to a safe learning environment. The definition of teen dating violence is amended to include sexual abuse and removal of the word pattern, as use of this word indicates that a single incidence of violence in a teen dating situation would not be sufficient for response.
Thank you. And since you're representing your peer group, either one of you, you can just either one can start.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and members of the Human Services Committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey, and I have the honor of representing House District 42. I really want to thank you today for bringing up this important issue and hearing it today. You've heard from your committee administrator, I think, a really important point that I want to draw out initially and then expand on why this bill, what we're doing, and what the process is here. And as we just heard, this is about permissive language for counties to deal with prevention. We are enabling counties to work on prevention. Now, we learn when we're young that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and then sometimes I think we forget that pretty quickly when we grow up and start making public policy. This is about breaking the cycle early. This is about getting involved in the lives of young women and young men at a point when they can learn healthy relationships going forward, and that's why we're calling this the Healthy Teen Relationship Act. It is so critical to make a difference at this point in a young person's life, not only to give them a better quality of life and a better chance at success in school, a better chance at a successful life, but to affect the entire trajectory of how that person is able to live and work in our society. Studies show that breaking the cycle early can have an influence on graduation rates, on incarceration rates, on mental health issues, on drug abuse, and on the entire arc of a person's life. And getting involved early, getting involved at a point where we can alter that trajectory, getting involved at a point where we can make a real difference means so much. Now, Oregon, I'm sorry to say, on a national ranking list put out by Break the Cycle, ranks a D on teen dating abuse awareness. We are sandwiched between two states that earned an A in California and an A in Washington. And a big part of the reason that California and Washington have A grades is that their legislature has made a clear and definitive statement that there must be a program and a policy to begin to address teen dating violence in schools. Now, when I talk about teen dating violence, what I'm talking about is a pattern of behavior that exerts power and control over a dating partner. This can be physical abuse, it can be emotional abuse and controlling behaviors, and it can be sexual abuse. And some of it intersects with some of the work we've done on bullying in the past in this legislature. Some of it intersects with some of the work that we've done on sexual violence in the past in this legislature. But it really is its own distinct issue and has its own distinct challenges. And we've heard from advocates and anecdotal evidence that the structures in place right now to deal with this in the school system are inadequate. And so what this bill does is it takes a modest step forward at a time when we are budget constrained in a way that we can start to put the structures in place to address this issue, to enable prevention, and to get the data and the studies that we need to fully understand the scope of this problem. Now, you have a bill before you, and you have a Dash 1 amendment. I want to walk through it very briefly and then turn it over to my colleague, Representative Doherty, as well as a number of stakeholders and advocates here who can talk to you a little bit more about this bill. We have been working on this bill since early 2010 in collaboration with Raphael House of Portland and the Oregon Law Center, both organizations that I know that you have some familiarity with. And the bill as written in 2438 requires school districts to have a district-wide plan for teen domestic violence, or teen dating violence, identifies a mix of funding mechanisms that advocates and educators can use to be able to, which may include matching funds, which they can use to begin to address this issue. It creates a fund, and let me emphasize, it creates a fund for a long-term longitudinal study, and it includes provisions around teen dating violence on the Healthy Teen Survey from DHS. Now, there's a Dash 1 amendment that you have in front of you. We have a Dash 2 that is pending. The Dash 2 will be slightly different than the Dash 1, but the major changes are in the Dash 1. First, the Dash 1 removes what is in the original bill, which was an increase in the divorce filing fee. And in the current climate, I think what we're going to have to do is make a permissive use of funds rather than creating a new fee that would go towards funding it. Second, the Dash 2s get some of the language right around prevention and support and around how we can ensure that school districts can use some of the things that they're already doing around bullying and around sexual violence to begin to build off of those programs and the person that's been identified at the district level as the bullying coordinator through the bill that we passed during the last session so that they aren't incurring significant new mandates or new costs. It has some other technical changes around patterns of abuse and some changes to ensure that we're getting right at the issue that we want to get at and the correct definitions. But the point here is that we can't wait. We have a difficult budget challenge in front of us. It's sometimes difficult to look at the long run. It's sometimes difficult to look at how we can enable the right structures and the right programs today that are going to enable this state to be able to save money in the future the costs of providing services to those in need. But this issue has come to a head. It is one that is urgent, requires us to address it this session, and we cannot be the state that has the D between the states, two states that have A's. We have to act now this session, and I thank you for bringing forward this bill.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. I'm Representative Margaret Doherty, and I represent House District 35. And I'm here today in a couple of roles. First of all, to talk a little bit from the education standpoint. As a former educator, I understand the impact of personal challenges that students face, whether it be home challenges or whether it be challenges in their personal life. And if we want to focus on our students' success, we need to make sure that the classroom is a safe place for them to learn and that society is a safe place for them to be. It is not unreasonable to do what is necessary to ensure that this environment is provided for all Oregon students. And those of you that are parents, think back to when your children became middle school children and how all of a sudden there was this transformation. And one day they were sweet little children that wanted to come in and mommy and daddy give them a hug, and the next day it was don't touch me. And that was what we see in the middle schools, especially, is the transformation, especially with young women, when it comes to self-esteem. And there are a lot of programs that they start working in middle school because all of a sudden the middle school girls who were very, very smart in science and math, all of a sudden that's not so important, but having a boyfriend is. And so the education component in this, I think, is critical. Not only the education component for children, but also hopefully down the road for the parents. With the change in technology, there's a little kind of an additional layer to this, and it's kind of a mental and emotional barrier of you can't use your text to talk to anybody but me. And these we've seen in the middle schools, and I think it's something that needs to be changed. One of the biggest problems here is that we don't know really what the scope of the problem is. As Representative Bailey mentioned, other states have started to focus on preventative measures rather than addressing domestic violence once it manifests, and we're hoping that this would be something that would at least curb domestic violence. The provisions of this bill will help us determine the scope of the problem and how to approach it. It's time for Oregon to take the stand now, saving that this behavior will not be tolerated, and letting, as I say, getting this up to an A so the entire West Coast can be A states in this. We've worked to address the problems brought forth by many stakeholders, and Representative Bailey also mentioned that, dropping the divorce fee and dealing with the fiscal aspects of it, considering the climate that we're in. Understand that there are concerns from some of the stakeholders, but we're trying to work with them to try to find solutions. While there are similarities of this bill to the bullying statute, there is a fundamental difference. Relationship experiences that teens have, both positive and negative, impact their future relationships and health, which is why it's so important to have a differentiate from the problem. And just kind of on a personal note, when the shooting took place in West Virginia with the college students in the summer, or at last spring. It kind of brought back a little bit of a memory, and I remember when I was a freshman in college, I had a boyfriend who I didn't think was abusive until he slammed me against a wall. Those of you that know me, I would not tolerate something like that, and nor I did tolerate anything like that. But I think I'm the rule rather than the exception. Or I'm the exception rather than the rule when it comes to that aspect. So I think it's something very, very important. The middle school through teen years are very, very fragile for a lot of these kids. And I think one more thing that we can do to help them become healthy adults is something that is necessary at this time. Thank you very much. I'm open for questions.
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks to both of you for testimony and bringing this forward. California and Washington each have an A grade, and they each have a policy something like this in place. Do they also have better statistics than we do, or is the difference in the grade primarily associated with having the policy in place? I would hope that the policy could then translate into better statistics in this regard, but I'm curious.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Harker, it's a great question, and my understanding, and perhaps there may be some other folks in the audience who are going to testify who can speak with a little bit more authority about exactly what the metrics were on how the grades were given in Washington and California. My understanding is that Washington received an A grade because their state law requires the development of a family preservation education program model curriculum that includes instruction on dating violence, and that the California legislature expressed its intent that schools provide age-appropriate instruction in dating violence prevention. But to your larger question of how does the policy translate to metrics, what is the data that we have, and how do we track the progress in that over time, that really gets to the heart of the issue of this bill, in that that's why we have the provision around the longitudinal study in this bill, in that the data out there isn't great. We need to really better understand how an intervention now affects that arc of a person's life over time, both for the victim as well as for the abuser, and how that investment now has that ripple effect down the line. Now, I wish we had a budget situation where we could fund a really robust longitudinal study in this state and get the data that we need. Unfortunately, we're not in that situation. So what this bill does and the amendment that you have in the Dash 1 cribs off the work of House Bill 3363 on a completely different issue from last 2010 session. We have some indications that some national foundations, including perhaps Robert Wood Johnson Foundation through some of their work, may be interested in funding some of this research in a state that is starting to implement these policies. And it creates an open account that has receipts authority for that kind of grant or award. And then there is a time-specific limit. It asks the department to conduct the study. with funds from that account if they're received. If they are not received, the mandate to conduct the study is repealed automatically in the legislation. So we've created a way to say, hey, if we're able to go out and raise the funds to do that, this would be great to have. If we're not, we can't afford it right now. But it's very important to get that data.
Please.
Mm-hmm. Are there states that stand out in terms of having much happier statistics or metrics than the majority of the states do?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Harker, my understanding is that Oregon is lower on the list of states in terms of our ability to respond and deal with these issues. Some of the advocates who are coming later can probably talk to you a little bit more about some of the other states and their specific statistics.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is an extraordinarily important problem. But I think of the DARE program, which has been proven to be ineffective yet greatly revered in the schools, and wonder whether there are any evidence-based interventions that have actually been shown to work.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Greenlake, again, that is exactly the point of trying to enable this money to go towards prevention programs and then studying best practices on that intervention program. So you referenced evidence-based policy, and I'm sure the committee is very familiar with what evidence-based policy is. But as we look at how we do policy evaluations, how we do a study over time of what the effect of these interventions are, and then are able to produce some very clear data points on what the best intervention is and how those programs work. What we need first, especially in the Oregon context, is an ability for us to be able to use some of the money that's currently directed at response for prevention, if that makes sense. So right now we're not in a position to be able to study it in Oregon because we can't effectively have a program that we can measure.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up? I mean, if we're talking about creating a giant research project, I'm a researcher. I love it. So let's get some universities in and start doing some research in this. But if we're talking about getting policies in place that depend on interventions, my question is, are there interventions that these counties can put in place now that have been shown to make a difference? We can follow up with what the effect of them will be, but do we have tools, proven tools, to put in place, and if we say, you counties, you put these in place, it will help to mediate this problem, help to mitigate the problem.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Greenlake, the short answer is yes. Mm-hmm. And you will hear from Raphael House that they have a program that they've developed and are currently using in schools on a very limited basis because of the dynamics of how monies can be used around these programs and how it intersects with the school districts and their policies. But they have an effective program that is having a real effect on people's lives. And so what we want to do is build off that success.
One more question.
Please.
If I could add one thing, excuse me. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Representative Greenlake, the Tigard Police Department also has a program when they have their, and this is where we get the stakeholders together to work with it. They have a self-defense program for teenagers, and in that is a component for teen dating violence. I might have a different term, but it goes through, and that is part of the component of their training in self-defense for young girls, and I know that they are willing to work with all of the different stakeholders in a program that eventually, once the information is given, to try to use it in a preventative way.
Oh, I'm sure there are 1,000 programs. My question is, are there any of them that have been proven to actually work? I mean, this isn't the only area where this is a problem. I mean, I spend a lot of time in a lot of areas trying to produce evidence and substance abuse and a lot of other things. Everybody has a program. The fact is, most of them don't really work. But my final question is, there are 2 states that have an A and we're in a D. And is the data available on date violence significantly different, let's say, between Washington and Oregon in terms of the outcome where they have the A program and we have the D one?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Greenlake, yeah, I think that gets back to Representative Harker's question and can be happy to provide the data to that committee.
Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, you're fine.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I mean, there are data about violence. I mean, there are prosecutions, there are all sorts of data. And in the existing data on the outcome, let's say, prosecutions for sex, date violence, are the official data different, say, between Washington and Oregon?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Green, like, if I think I'm understanding your question correctly, do those states track differently the data on dating violence versus other forms of violence? Is that your question?
Well, I mean, there's crime data. You don't, you know, there's data on crimes. FBI puts out other. Are there differences in those official data in terms of what's being prosecuted, who's being put in jail?
Representative Kutcher Gilliam, Representative Greenlake, there is data on teen dating violence. We'll be happy to get that to you.
Thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Yes. We had in the Portland schools for many years a child development specialist. They were primarily at the elementary school level, and they did a remarkable job. I'm not sure how many of them still exist after the budget cuts that have taken place in Portland. And they were very effective on violence of all sorts. And it just occurs to me that the hormonal imbalance that takes place in terms of middle schools is significant. But if you are able to reach and deal with issues before that, via the child development specialists at the elementary school level, that there seems to be a significant impact. It certainly seemed to make sure that there was a different level of violent episodes on all levels when they got to high school. Do we already have a number of these things? Who's collecting those? Who's looking at that in much the same way that Representative Greenlick is suggesting? I'd like to see what kind of data we have about these particular efforts, and basically sort of understanding that we're already addressing it. Who's doing it and where? Are you going to have folks coming up to be able to speak to that, or do you have a sense of that right now?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Frederick, with regards to the pre-middle school issue, we can certainly get some information for you on that. And this is definitely, there is an enormous scope to how we help children as they grow and develop over time, become participants in society and have healthy relationships of all kinds. I think what we're trying to really focus down on is a at-risk population here of folks that are engaged in dating relationships and need to have the information and the ability to understand better the kinds of issues that can come up in teen dating violence relationships. And we need to have the ability to do some prevention in schools and to have school districts have a plan as those issues arrive. Now, I know that this committee deals with extremely complex and big issues. I would not pretend that this bill, House Bill 2438, is going to solve the problem overnight or address the larger scope of sort of how we have healthy human interactions in schools. But I do think it is a modest step forward that's needed in order to start generating the programs and the data to be able to track progress and enable districts and ask them to have a plan and enable them to do these kinds of interventions.
Thank you.
You have any follow-up on it? Just before my co-chair goes, I just wanted to say I don't want us to get too hung up on the grade card, but I think we're all interested in a little more information, just some documentation on where that comes from. And to echo some of the sentiments I've heard so far, and I know you two agree, we also want to carefully look at what works now. Mm-hmm. So perhaps our neighbors to the north and south who are getting an A can be a source mm-hmm. for additional assistance that's available. You know, what they're doing right to get their A is something we could borrow crib from, your words, and move forward. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thanks for mentioning child development specialists in Portland Public Schools. I was a child development specialist at a time mm-hmm. when there were child development specialists in all elementary schools. And there are longitudinal studies that show the difference in behavior for those children who went through that through the child development specialists at their elementary school that shows, I'm not sure it shows about dating violence, but it does show other antisocial behaviors and alcohol and drug abuse and smoking. So I'd be glad to try to find those also, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Thank you. We'll look forward to that. Well, I think we'll let our colleagues off the hook if you all are okay with that. And we thank you both very much for coming and bringing this bill forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, co-chairs.
See and you on the floor.
We'll be available, but I think we each have hearings. In other
I'm just next
in other rooms, but okay. We'll be next door if there are additional questions. Be happy to come back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to ask that Sybil Hebb come up now so I don't, you know, goof that one up again. No. Sybil, will you come up because we'd love to hear from you. Also, Catherine Bradley and Lori Sappenspiel. And Sattenspiel, excuse me. I know better, Lori. Sorry. And please identify yourselves. I'm step out for just a second. I'll be right back, but we'll continue.
Welcome. Whomever wants to start.
Chair Tomei, Representative Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here in support of House Bill 2438. Appreciate very much Representative Bailey and Representative Daugherty's primary sponsorship of this bill and work on it. From the Law Center's perspective, our mission is to provide access to justice for low-income people. We, over the years, have had an increasing number of clients coming into our offices seeking assistance because of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking that they have suffered. And those dynamics have an incredible impact on clients' lives. The chaos, the fear, the suffering that ensues from going through an experience like that has an impact on people's jobs, their work life, their ability to support their families, their safety, and their housing, many, many other circumstances. And so for this reason, we, as the Law Center, have become very concerned about what our overall state sort of coordinated response is to try to get our arms around the issue of this public health and safety problem that impacts our families and our communities across the state. For this reason, we are interested in this bill and very supportive of the concepts that are at its heart. There were questions earlier about how Oregon compares to other states, and there are probably some specifics that I can't give you today, but I'll give you the ones that I can and happy to follow up. What we have seen over the past couple of years is that though crime in Oregon is generally steady or in some cases, some circumstances going down, the rate of domestic violence has not gone down. In fact, it has gone up. Specifically, the fatalities that Oregon has suffered as a result of domestic violence have increased significantly over the past couple of years. You may remember in 2009, in late 2009, there was a horrible spate of tragedies in which 18 people lost their lives within less than 30 days as a result of domestic violence. And those fatalities included men, women, and children. And so I think the state as a whole was horrified when that happened. We wondered, is this a crazy spike, what's happening here, and what unfortunately we've seen, and I think the numbers are in my testimony. I'm happy to provide further clarification. But in 2010, the trend continued, and in 2010, there were 48 people killed as a whole, including 5 children as a result of domestic violence or by domestic violence perpetrators. That number doesn't include 18 perpetrators who then shot themselves and committed suicide or lost their lives because of law enforcement response in trying to address the safety issues that were at the heart of the crisis. And so this is a tragedy that we don't have our arms around, and those fatalities are just the tip of the iceberg. Oregon has had a higher rate of fatalities in the past couple of years compared to other states. And again, I want to stress that those fatalities are the worst possible outcomes of the incidents of domestic violence, but they are the tip of the iceberg, and what we know is that there are many, many more cases, some of which we don't even hear about, and reporting and keeping data about these instances is sometimes difficult in any state because of the barriers to coming forward. But the numbers that we are able to track show us that 85,000 Oregonians were victims within the last 5 years of serious physical violence, that our rates of sexual assault amongst young people is high. Christine Herman from the Sexual Assault Task Force can provide you more specific information about that. But this problem exists across all populations, and it's not going away, and in fact it's increasing. One of the reason, or a number of the other reasons that Oregon has gotten a D rating compared to other states has to do with lack of services and protection availability for teens who are victims of domestic violence or sexual assault. Curricula, school curricula, is one of the criteria that are used to make a determination of what the grade should be. And I think the theory there is that if teens don't have an ability to come forward and make a report, and they don't have anywhere to go with anyone to talk to about their the violence that they're suffering, they're more likely to suffer longer in silence and sustain greater rates of injury. What statistics show, and there's a document attached to the back of my testimony that has some information from the Family Violence Prevention Fund. Statistics show that, unfortunately, many of our parents are not aware of the dangers that their teens may be facing. Some of them may be afraid to acknowledge. Others may just simply not be supportive or capable. But the fact is that teens do not have, many of them, a resource in their parents and do not make reports to their parents or to disclose. Making sure that our school educators are educated about this issue and aware of it, and that there are reporting mechanisms in place so that teens know they can come forward and that there will be a response that will be geared towards safety and prevention, makes a difference. And we think, and there are studies cited in the sheet attached to my testimony, that early intervention does help turn around violent behavior, both from perpetrators, and it's not violent behavior on the behalf of victims, but early intervention makes it more likely that victims will be able to achieve safety and less likely to become further future victims. It also helps turn people who have the potential to become violent abusers. It gives them a shot at understanding the consequences and the nature of their actions, and gives them a shot of having help in achieving a different form of behavior. Sometimes perpetrators are violent because they're suffering abuse at home. And so having a way in which the school is more able to respond to those instances helps on both sides of that factor. I want to wrap up. I know I'm taking more time than I had planned. I guess the other thing I would I'd stress is that there are 9 other states so far that have curricula requirements and reporting requirements in school situations other than Oregon. They're similar to the ones that are proposed by this bill. Many of them have not been in place for a very long time, and so much of the data that has been requested here may not be specifically available. But I think that in general, the statistics will bear out that early intervention and a means to make a report do help address safety threats. And so for those reasons, we're very supportive of the purpose of this bill, and we'll look forward to becoming a further part of the dialogue as it moves forward. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Gilliam and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Family Health. The Office of Family Health has been working with our injury and violence prevention program. Lisa Mier was going to be here today to present but is ill. But this has been a partnership that we've been working on together. We tend to handle some of the policy issues working with children, adolescents, and women's health issues. We're here today to provide testimony on this bill and to address some changes that we are working on with Representative Bailey's office that will be coming forward in the future. You've got the testimony in front of you. Just a couple of points. The Oregon Healthy Teens Survey from 2009 does have some information. We have one question currently right now that asks the question about whether a boyfriend or girlfriend had purposely hit, slapped, or physically hurt them in the last 12 months. A rate of about 6.5% has been reported by both boys and girls from the 11th grade from our last survey in 2009. It's important to know that we also correlate this with other questions that we have in that survey, and so that we do know that young women and men who are more likely to be physically hit are also more likely to have higher rates of reporting poor overall health, higher rates of considering suicide, and also higher rates of being harassed by their peers. So the correlation of these issues we know is pretty significant. The other thing that I would share with you is in this last year, the state Title V block grant, which is the maternal child health block grant, is required every 5 years to conduct a survey and redefine what their priorities are. When we did this in 2010, the number one issue across all of our populations was, again, violence prevention. So whether it was with pregnant women, whether it was with mothers, whether it was with teens and children, so it could be bullying, it could be intimate partner violence, it could be domestic violence. That was the number one issue that we identified that was a concern from a public health perspective. So it is a lot of work that we are doing in collaboration with our partners. The other point that we wanted to make, and this is one of the considerations we are suggesting, the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey is administered every other year to 8th and 11th graders. So rather than have a separate survey on teen dating violence, one of the possibilities would be to consider incorporating a module of 8 specific questions that have been tested in other states into the survey and to use this as a method of data collection over time. We are not currently collecting this question in the 8th grade. We discontinued that in 2007. Part of the reason was the low incidence at that time, which was less than 4%. But there would be a potential that we could incorporate this again for both 8th and 11th graders and use a larger module. And that's some of the work we're working on currently with Representative Bailey. I think, in summary, the Oregon Health Authority does support programs and initiatives that prevent teen dating violence. It's consistent with our Oregon Youth Sexual Health Plan, which, as one of its 5 elements, does really speak to reducing non-consensual sexual behaviors, including dating violence, and we are available to you for any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards. I provided with you 2 separate sample policies that our organization makes available to local school districts. They can model their policy after what they see as their local needs. And in the policy, JFCF is the actual bullying harassment, which some of this would rise to the level of, and we're working with the proponents as well to figure out if we can put that into this, if we need to do something maybe totally different. Our policy folks have worked in the past when we did 2599 last session with a major rewrite of our policy on bullying and harassment. The other policy, IGAI, is actually our health education policy. And as you can see, we work with the Department of Education, and I want to highlight they are in the room today should you have questions about specific health-related information that they might be able to answer for us. It goes through from, you know, sex ed all the way to the health education. Pointing out on item 7 on page 2, it talks about, you know, healthy relationships, and so it's embedded into a lot of the material, and if we need to make some adjustments based on surveys, we'd be happy to see what we could do with that to be of assistance. A couple things that I just wanted to also highlight on the actual a bill, first page, dating relationship. For me personally, for my era, having a definition of what that is today might be different than what it was when I was dating. So I don't know, that might need to have a second look, and we have been talking with the proponents as well about that. It talks in here about a bus stop, incidents at a bus stop. That's not on the school grounds, and we'd be hard-pressed to do much with a bus stop should there be something going on there. I think I'll just open myself up for questions if you have, and I'll see what I can answer for you. Thank you.
Thank you. And committee, you might have noticed we have some guests in the room. I wanted to welcome the Clackamas County Youth Leadership and Adult Leadership Program. You probably know that you're in the House Committee on Human Services, and we're listening to testimony on a bill regarding teen dating violence. So welcome. Stay as long as you can, but we're glad you're here. Colleagues, do you have questions for this panel? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Ms. Heeb, I'm looking at your testimony. You have under what works to mitigate the harmful impacts of witnessing violence. 13 studies. None of them look like they're intervention studies. They look like they're association. So I'm back to my question. If any of you have some references about evidence-based practices that actually work, have been proven to work, this is a very important problem. So is hunger, so is homelessness, so is disease. There's a lot of important problems. One of the problems is we've had trouble finding ways to intervene. So anything you to help give me some information about what you might actually do that has been proven to matter would be helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you, Representative Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the educational side, have you had many schools ask for this program or for something to be done here?
I believe all 197 school districts have some sort of policy in place that deals with health education. What they choose in the curriculum, they work with the department and they come up with what they're going to actually for their local needs.
Right. Then, actually, this might be Sybil. This is going to be a little bit of a statement here, but I'm just trying to figure out how California gets an A grade when their percentage is higher than ours. I mean, their boys are getting beat by a full 1.1% more than our boys by their girlfriends. And
Representative, would you reference the data there? Because I forgot the name of the study that you're...
I'm just going by the numbers that we got on.
I thought you were looking online because Representative Bailey mentioned the group that did this report card, and I don't know who it was.
And then I have Kids Data, who is doing California's, so but I'm comparing the two between each other. So
okay,
I grabbed online. So anyway, it's just showing that our numbers are already lower, and we don't even have a program in place. So I'm just trying to figure out, is this going to be something, another mandate that we're putting on our education system that, no, you will do it this way, and we see no results for it, and then I deal with my administrators and my local school districts upset because now I have to put somebody in this position, we get no results for it, and how much of it crosses over into mental health? Because with this low in numbers, I bet you we would find some of these students are probably dealing with some mental health issues that we need to work with there on that side. So I would like to have your comments on that, Sybil.
Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and Representative Widener, members, it's a good question. I think that, and I can provide further statistics about this, but I think what happens is when you start to provide a safe place for people to come and talk about what they're suffering, you tend to start to hear more reports. And we're at the beginning stages in Oregon of identifying the fact that teens suffer from domestic and sexual violence. And, you know, our Family Abuse Prevention Act, which provides the ability to seek restraining orders, does not address that circumstance, and teens are at a reduced ability to seek protection from the courts when they're suffering. And by the same token, it's much harder for a teen who is a victim to access shelter at a domestic violence emergency shelter. And so there are lots of barriers to teens coming forward to talk about what they're suffering. And I think by putting into place a system by which it's okay, it's number one identified that this is a dynamic that exists and that it's not healthy or safe, and that people then can think, wow, maybe what's happening to me is not right and it's wrong, and maybe there's help available and there's a place that I can go and get some help and a response, then you start to see more people coming forward. And so when you have the right policies in place, sometimes your numbers go up. And that doesn't mean that you're having a greater incidence. It just means that you're doing a better job of identifying the problem. And I think to Representative Greenlich's question, there is not as much statistical evidence as we would like on this issue and on what exactly works. And I think that's because we're so much at the beginning of trying to address the problem. So that's my answer.
Follow up? So I'm sitting here looking at it, and when you're dating, you're with that person all the time. You're exposing yourself to them. I have four boys. I'm batting 100% record with my boys fighting with each other all the time. So, and they would fall under this category. So I'm just wondering if the violence is coming from just being in close quarters with each other all the time. When you're dating, you become possessive. There's some things there that, I mean, it's kind of the beginning steps as you go to marriage and things like that, where they're learning how to have a relationship with somebody. And I'm wondering, just looking at the percentage, if that could be a normal percentage for just teenagers getting to know each other and knowing the opposite person.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Widener, I think that's in some ways exactly why we want to get involved early, because I think it's important to, you know, there's some circumstances in which people are struggling to learn what the norms are, what appropriate behavior is, and children struggle with that more, hopefully, than adults do. And I think making sure that there is a set of standards that does prohibit the use of violence, and maybe a single incidence or roughhousing, you know, that's different than the pattern of perpetual use of violence to try to control and manipulate a person. And there will be, and there was a question as to what is dating, and I think those are legitimate questions. The schools and teachers implementing this policy, if it moves forward or as it moves forward, and they do this now, so, you know, I think that the bill will help provide some consistency around how this happens, but you have to use your judgment. And a single instance of, you know, roughhousing is not the same thing as a person you see cowering in the corner and always with her boyfriend or his girlfriend, and it's visible to everybody that that's not a safe or okay scenario. And we want to make sure that people stuck in those relationships where they're unsafe emotionally, psychologically, physically, we want to make sure that those people have avenues by which they can come forward and seek help. And then we hope that the professionals in charge of administering this use their judgment and their understanding about what's the best way to respond so that we can get safety for the person if they need it, and help to the person who is behaving inappropriately to try to turn that behavior around as well. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that it's a really nasty problem. It's really pervasive. It doesn't seem like it's worse here, where we have a D grade, than in the two of the surrounding states that get A grades. It's not just the left coast. It's not just the U.S. It happens in all cultures. It's also not just humans. It's a really nasty problem that needs to be dealt with, right? I wish we had something that was being brought to us. You probably wish you were bringing something to us that really could deal effectively with this. I'm somewhat hesitant, reluctant to pass something on to the districts, to anyone, that they need to do, that we don't have a pretty good reason to believe really makes a difference. It looks like it'll get us an A, but it doesn't look like it will improve our statistics, our metrics. I could still pass this. I could still move this forward, and maybe I'd feel a little bit better about myself or about the committee or about the state, but I'm not, like, gung-ho. Whoops, sorry.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think you make an excellent point, and I don't think anybody is saying that this is going to take care of the problem.
I know.
But I think, especially in this economic climate, this is a tiny step that we can begin to take, and I think it's the first step that's needed. We know it's a huge problem. This is not going to take care of it. But I think it's the first step to begin to get a grasp on it, and so that we can take care of it.
And do we have it down to a point with the latest amendments where it's not going to cost anything? It's permissive. It's establishing a fund. It may still impose some new requirements upon districts.
Yeah, those are two different issues, I think. And just to clarify your question, as I understand it, we've taken out the fee part of it, which was dealing with dissolution of marriage. The cost part of it still, I think, needs to be discussed, because there will be a cost. But that part of the fiscal has been removed with the amendment, as I understand it. The other quick thing I would say is, I'm interested, as I know the committee is, it's hard here when we don't have the data in front of us. I'm very grateful for references here to our Oregon Healthy Teen Survey. I'm sure the committee would like to have a little more
background on that, if you can provide it. And then the second thing is this, I'd like to chase down a little bit more about the grade card, the grade report card that Representative Bailey talked about. So we're all looking forward to that and any other data, but we'll continue to think about those things between now and whenever we might have the next hearing. If there's no other questions for this panel, I'll thank you all three for coming up. And we have three more folks signed up to testify, colleagues. So if Ashley, Megan, and Amanda will come back up. We will continue. Why don't you begin?
Me?
Yes.
Okay.
You are a veteran today.
Good morning, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Megan Kovacs, and I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator at Raphael House of Portland. My primary position at Raphael House of Portland has been in the past few years that I've been working at Raphael House to create and implement an education and outreach program primarily in high schools and middle schools. I speak to the community, I speak to DHS, I speak to Legal Aid, I speak to many members of the community to raise awareness about domestic violence, but primarily, I can be found on most days in high schools and in middle schools providing education around teen dating violence, around healthy relationships and unhealthy relationships, and when those unhealthy relationships might become something that we would consider warning signs. We talk about many different issues, and in my experience working with teens over the past 5 years, I've talked to thousands of teenagers, and many of them, one of the primary problems is that many of them don't know what a healthy relationship looks like. Many of them have not had that experience at home, have not had the experience in their community to be told that what they deserve and what their rights are in a relationship. I've worked with so many teenagers who have told me, wow, talking about a healthy relationship, talking about what respect should look like and should mean to me is the first time that this is something I've ever heard. I was actually in a classroom on Friday working with a group of five behaviorally challenged boys, and one of them started crying when we started talking about what respect is and what that looks like, because he has never talked about that. He's never learned what respect means and what that looks like and what that should mean to him. It is imperative to start talking about these things in schools, because this isn't education that teens are getting. This isn't the education that youth is getting from a young age about what they deserve and what they should expect in relationships. I have some statistics from recent surveys that I've done with students that I've worked with. 93% have indicated that prior to the presentations, that they had little or no knowledge of domestic violence. And these are surveys that I just do after the presentations, after I go into classrooms and talk to teenagers. 71% indicated that they had little or no knowledge of what teen dating violence was prior to presentations. 93% indicated that they had an increased knowledge about the topic after the presentations. So I don't know how effective, these presentations are in actually preventing domestic violence, but it is at least increasing the knowledge that students have. It is increasing the knowledge that students have about the effects of violence that has on their own lives. It's increasing their knowledge about what a healthy relationship should look like. What their expectations for a dating partner should be. By creating policy, by creating district policy in order to, implement a program like this, it's giving students a way of talking about it in schools. And I think, that is a primary problem in people accessing resources, is not knowing what they can expect when they go to access resources. And, in turn also not knowing that this is something that they can access resources for. Like I said at the beginning, this is something that a lot of people don't identify as a problem. When I first started doing this work, trying to get into schools, a lot of schools told me that this wasn't a problem in their school. This wasn't something that they see happening. This wasn't something that happens in their school. And I think that has traditionally been how we talk about domestic violence, is this isn't something that's happening in my community. This isn't something that's happening to us. What we know, and in my experience, is this is something that's happening everywhere and in every school. Whether or not people talk about it, that's part of the problem, is that people don't feel comfortable talking about it. This is an issue that has been stigmatized. This is an issue that has been silenced, and especially for teenagers, especially when there isn't a place for teenagers to speak about this. There isn't a place where they're being told that this isn't something that's okay. So by, you know, taking the step of enacting HB 2438, you know, we are telling teenagers that this is something that we care about as a community. You know, we want to start the conversation about what a healthy relationship is. We want to start talking about a person's rights in relationships from a young age so that, you know, they, when moving forward, when getting involved in more serious relationships, they know that they have the right to not be hurt by a partner. They know that control in a relationship is not something that's okay. They know that possessiveness and jealousy are things that are big warning signs of domestic and dating violence. I mean, those are some of the first warning signs we see of dating violence is, you know, when someone is really possessive and when someone is really jealous. And I think, you know, by being able to recognize and being able to identify those warning signs by creating curricula and creating policy, you know, we are really preventing this from happening in the future. And I think we do, like Representative Bailey said and Ms. Hebb said, we spend a lot of time focusing on providing services for survivors. And that is something that's obviously really important, but, you know, how we create real social change and how we're actually going to start changing this issue is by talking to teenagers, talking to youth about what this really looks like and what this really means and what their rights are. Thank you for your testimony today, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. We'll keep going and have questions at the end.
Okay. Hello. Representative Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and members of the committee, my name is Ashley Meyer. I am the Prevention Program Coordinator for the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, which is a 501c3 statewide organization. I'm also the former co-chair of the Teen Relationship Prevention Committee of the San Diego Domestic Violence Council in California. I also, in California, at the University of California San Diego School of Medicine, ran a training program for pediatricians and provided assistance to pediatricians on family violence, which included teen dating violence. One of the most important points that I think has been made here today is that the teenagers are really critical to growth and development. That's when we start thinking logically, we reason, we develop our critical thinking skills. And it's also a time that has been mentioned previously as well where relationships really mean the world to us. For many of us, that was how we defined ourselves. And for many youth these days, that's how they define themselves and are told to define themselves. Unfortunately, violence and abuse can mar those relationships and really interfere and push teens off the track of healthy development. We also know that thriving communities require thriving people. So from a prevention perspective, we really have to identify and promote healthy behaviors. We have to send the message not only that violence and abuse is unacceptable, but we also have to promote healthy, positive, pro-social behaviors. And teens are a critical part of this equation. Healthy teens become the healthy adults who shape Oregon's communities. Organizational environmental change is key to successful prevention and health promotion efforts. And so every institution and individual has a chance to reinforce healthy behaviors as well as to identify and address violent and abusive behaviors and attitudes in teens. We know that perpetrators who are identified as youth or teens are much more likely to change than those who are identified as adults. We owe it to teens to make sure that they don't end up as perpetrators and abusers, and we have an obligation to create environments that support their health and well-being. This bill takes a much-needed step towards fostering healthy communities by focusing on healthy teen relationships. For teens to thrive, they have to know what behaviors are expected of them, they have to receive support and encouragement for those behaviors, and they have to exist and operate within systems and environments that foster and promote those behaviors. The bill also recognizes that this is a really important public health issue, and it strives to produce the data that we need to inform successful public health efforts. We would like to thank Representative Bailey for also responding to our request to include sexual assault in the definition of teen dating violence, because young people do experience disproportionate rates of violence, including sexual violence. Additionally, sexual violence is most often perpetrated by someone known to the victim. So for both of those reasons, it's important that this bill speaks to the urgency of addressing sexual violence as well within the context of teen dating relationships. I'd also like to mention that as at the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, we provide rape prevention education funds to a number of local communities and nonprofit organizations, as well as community college as well, throughout Oregon. Some of these programs go into the schools, and those that do go into the schools have promising evaluation data that show positive outcomes. There's also an RTI report on the first-time prevention of first-time male perpetration of sexual violence that goes through a number of programs that are both promising and evidence-based for preventing that violence. And the most commonly recognized problem nationwide is the dearth of data that we have on this issue. Every conversation I have with the CDC, with other national prevention experts, always comes down to the fact that we need more evidence and we need more data. So for those reasons, we do urge you to consider passing House Bill 2438 with the noted amendment, and I'm very, very willing to answer questions, particularly those that refer to prevention. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairs Gilliam and Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amanda Green, and I'm a graduate student at Portland State University. However, today I'll be addressing you not only as a citizen activist, but also as the Associate Executive Director of PAVE, Promoting Awareness, Victim Empowerment. PAVE is a national sexual assault prevention organization that works to shatter the silence of sexual violence through arts, advocacy, and legislative action. Although our work has many facets, we work extensively on college campuses and with high school and middle school aged youth. We were recently listed as a resource for violence prevention on Oprah's website, and our work has been featured on CNN, The Today Show, and in Time Magazine. We currently have 35 chapters and affiliates across the country. We just got our first affiliate here in Oregon, in other words, bookstore, and we're working on establishing a chapter at Portland State University. I would like to voice not only PAVE's strong support of HB 2438, the Healthy Teen Relationships Act, but also my personal support as a survivor of teen dating violence. At the age of 16, I was drugged and assaulted by my boyfriend, whom, although I had only been dating for 2 months, I had gone to school and church with since kindergarten. After the assault, he threatened and emotionally manipulated me into silence. It was 3 years before I was able to talk about my abuse. In that time, I was ostracized by my religious community due to rumors that spread about the incident with my assaulter. Victimized again, I eventually lost my faith as well. I developed an eating disorder and suffered from crippling anxiety issues that resulted in my having to take a year out of college. And then I found PAVE on my college campus. PAVE's prevention-based peer-to-peer education program taught me that I was not alone, gave me a forum to share my story, get the support I needed, and I learned how to educate others about sexual assault and dating violence. As thankful as I am to have discovered PAVE in college, I wish that I had access to that kind of support immediately after my assault. Afterward, I had no one to talk to. I felt trapped and alone. I felt ashamed and guilty. I thought everything was my fault, and I had nobody to tell me otherwise. I was terrified to tell my mother, whom I thought would blame me much in the same vein as my faith community. There was nowhere else to go, so I didn't go anywhere. I didn't do anything except suffer in silence. These feelings are extremely common among survivors of interpersonal violence, especially among youth. The solutions offered by HB 2438 get at the heart of these problems. We need a system where youth can get the help they need. The bill provides a path for victims of teen dating violence to become survivors. It also calls for a much-needed study to gather Oregon-specific data, targeting resources here, and aiding violence in prevention and intervention work across the country. As everyone has alluded to today, there simply isn't data. Prevention-based data is really hard to find. And my other hat, I study public administration and nonprofit management, and performance measurement, especially surrounding prevention, is an issue that we talk about daily in our classes. We don't have metrics. We don't have good performance measurement to measure social value, especially in prevention. This part of the bill is so necessary, and the data that we might be able to gather here in Oregon can help the prevention movement everywhere. I do have a few statistics. They are a little bit outdated, and I can provide citations upon request. So approximately 1.8 million adolescents in the United States have been victims of sexual assault. 33% of sexual assaults occur when the victim is between the ages of 12 and 17. Teens 16 to 19 years of age are 3.5 times more likely than the general population to be victims of rape, attempted rape, or sexual assault. 67% of all victims of sexual assault reported to law enforcement were juveniles under the age of 18. More than half of these victims were under the age of 12. In 1999, 47% of child sex offenders were related to the victim, 49% were acquaintances, and 4% were strangers. I think you should pay particular attention to that. There's a stigma around sexual violence that it's stranger danger, and it's not. It's usually an acquaintance and usually a peer. One in four girls and one in six boys will be sexually assaulted before the age of 18. Teen sexual dating violence is a public health crisis here in Oregon and across the country. PAVE has seen great success through our prevention-based efforts on college campuses. Prevention education works, and we look forward to furthering this work in middle schools and high schools. And if anyone would like to see our data or our curriculum, I'm happy to share. My contact information is in my written testimony. PAVE is working on a similar effort to HTRA called Aaron's Law in states across the U.S. Aaron's Law focuses on sexual violence prevention and intervention in K-12 education. We passed it in Illinois, Iowa, and Texas, and we're working on it in several other states. I hope to see Aaron's Law proposed in Oregon during the next legislative session. Efforts like Aaron's Law and HTRA need partnership with school districts and legislatures to create policy that values this type of education in our schools. PAVE's mission is to shatter the silence of sexual violence, and I truly believe that the Healthy Teen Relationships Act provides a much-needed contribution to this effort. Thank you for hearing my testimony and for your support, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you for your testimony, and we've got a question. Before we get to that, I just wanted to say thank you all for your testimony, but especially to you, Amanda, for your courage and your honesty in coming. We appreciate it very much. I'm going to ask Co-Chair Tomei for her question.
Thank you.
One after you.
Thank you. Again, I echo what the co-chair said. Thank you so much for coming forward. Amanda, so are you in Oregon? Is your office in Oregon?
Actually, we're based in Virginia. We're a national organization. We started out as a student organization at the University of Wisconsin, where I went to undergrad. And we launched, a few of us banded together and launched together the national org about 3 years ago. We're tiny. We're all volunteer. Our budget is around $60,000 a year. And we do everything through grassroots advocacy. And we train facilitators that work in high schools and middle schools. But mostly we're on college campuses.
Follow up?
And you're a graduate student at Portland State.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, that was what I was after. Thank you. And so, well, if I follow up, so in what program are you at Portland State?
I'm getting my master's in public administration.
Great. Thanks for the work you're doing. This is fantastic. Thank you all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know, I've got a question for you, and it's a little bit odd, maybe. Of course, that won't surprise the committee. It's the definition. So when we go to codify or formalize legislation, my understanding of what dating is rooted in many, many decades ago context. And then I think the context of dating for my children, who are now both young adults, it may be different. Do you think that the definition, I don't know that you necessarily need to define it, although I'd be interested in that. Do you think the definition, using the word dating, limits us in some way when we're trying to address the bigger problem of teen violence against one another, whether it's dating or not? I just would say I remember vividly, to make this point, meeting a woman, a young girl, who I'd never seen before, who was with a friend of mine in high school. And I said, oh, who's this? To which he said, well, this is my girlfriend. To which she said, I'm not your girlfriend. So, you know, there can be misunderstanding about the whole idea of who's dating who.
I know a term that we use at PAVE is interpersonal relationship.
Yeah, and I was going to follow up and say that I think dating is a very subjective thing. As you know, as your story attests to, it is a very subjective thing, and you know that's one of the things that I do talk about often in the education that I provide. Is you know talking about what your level of commitment is, talking about what that means, is a really healthy thing in a relationship. But again, you know, a lot of students don't have the tools to do that. You know, defining it in a really big way is a really hard thing, and I think it's important to be as broad as possible, so because that can mean a lot of different things to different people.
And I would also say that what we know about what works in terms of the curricula and programs that are out there is that they always urge the facilitators to use the language that the youth are using. So the language that we use may be something that speaks for us. It's a general term, but the language that the programs are using are going to be very specific to the youth in that specific subculture and community.
Thank you.
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for all the work on a really important issue. I know I've been trying to drill down into it. Excuse me. And I don't want to be too left-brain about this and focus on statistics too much. It's only driven by my frustration that we can't do something more about it yet. But, Amanda, thanks for sharing your story. Do you believe that had this been in place, your life would have been a little bit different?
Yes, I do. I'm a person that I seek help when I need it, and but I also need to know where it is. And the second that I found PAVE in college, I magnetized towards it. I just went straight there, and I started dealing with my issues. If I had had something like that, or if I had been told, you know, by anybody in my faith community, anybody in my home life, any of my friends, that what had happened to me was considered sexual assault, that what had happened to me was wrong, I think that that would have changed my life dramatically and would have saved me a lot of grief. Because once I found out those things, I was really able to become a survivor. And that's not a word I would have used to describe myself for the years that happened after my assault.
Well, thank you, and congratulations for turning it around and into something obviously productive. Thanks.
Other questions for this panel?
No, thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2438. And, Madam Co-Chair, I'm going to give a heads up here to our colleagues, Representative Thompson and Representative Parrish, because I would like to suspend the rules for the purposes of letting both of them vote on our earlier action in the work session on House Bill 2217. Would you both like to take advantage of that suspension?
Appreciate that.
If I don't have any objection to the suspension of the rules,
I was going to move that. I thought you might want a motion on the floor.
Then, with hearing, seeing no objection, I'm going to ask the clerk to ask both Representative Thompson and Representative Parrish how they vote on the motion of moving. It was Representative Tomei's motion to move House Bill 2217 to be referred to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference. If you'd call the roll for these two.
Aye.
Aye. Wait, you did this out of order. Ask him again. I can't answer before she asks you.
Same answer, aye.
All right, so
he
recorded.
Nodded to me in a progressive way.
So, well, okay. So those votes are recorded. And now I'd like to, we're not going to get to all these, but I'd like to at least get to one of our HJMs, House Joint
Memorial.
I need all the help I can get. I'd like to open a work session on House Joint Memorial number 4. And colleagues, have we discussed, is there anyone in the room that has a comment on this memorial? If not, I'll ask my colleagues if they do.
I do.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, sir. I'd like to put on the record that I think nothing we do in the House of Representatives is more useless than all these resolutions we pass.
Well, thank you, Representative. I would disagree with you, but I'm not going to indicate what
that's
those.
Just for the record.
I'm not going to indicate what those things I think are more useless. But I appreciate your opinion on that one. Any other comments on the actual memorial, Representative
Widener,
personal friend of mine.
Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Tomei, I think sometimes we do a memorial or a resolution just so we can feel good, kind of like when we pass bills on to other committees like Ways and Means to know they're going to die. And at least a memorial is letting people feel good that we're doing something and urging Congress to support us.
These inspirational words really bode well for this memorial. Now, let's focus back on the memorial. And as you know, in the summary, it just simply says, urges Congress to mandate limit on mental health care caseloads. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move HJM 4 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
With a be adopted.
Be adopted. Why is it be adopted instead of do pass?
Memorial.
Oh, okay. Thank you. To with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Tomei has moved House Joint Memorial Number 4 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Seeing no further rousing discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Wyman.
Aye.
Representative Barrett.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Greenlick.
Abstain.
Present.
I'll vote later.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Oh, aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Gilley.
Aye. Aye. House Joint Memorial Number 4, receiving the required majority or votes, enthusiastic votes, is declared passed and will be sent to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Mr. Chair, could I...
Vice Chair Thompson.
On a positive note.
Yes.
Could I ask that we ask our committee staff to copy us on the response from Congress when they act on this?
Yes. Let us know immediately, please, Jennifer.
Okay, I will.
I mean, probably the Speaker will call us personally, but nonetheless.
Yeah,
Representative Greenlick? No, I'm just kidding. Do I have a volunteer for this joint memorial?
Consent report.
Yeah, consent calendar.
Consent calendar.
I don't know that representative. What's he or she look like?
He looks invisible.
If we're all agreed on the consent calendar for this, then that's the way it shall be. You know, these are so invigorating. I'd just like to hold them over for when Representative Tomei.
Thanks a lot.
Do you want to do one more, or should we?
Let's do one more.
Let's do it.
All right.
I don't
even
know
what
you're
around
from. So,
okay.
I'm going to close the work session on House Joint Memorial Number 4, and I'm going to open work sessions on House Joint Memorials 12 and
13.
And the chair will entertain motions on both.
Mr. Chair, I move HJM 12 with -1 amendment to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Tomei has moved House Joint Memorial 12 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Greenlick.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative
Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Wyman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Gilley.
Aye.
Chair Gilley.
Aye. So, House Joint Memorial 12, as amended, which we all know urges the resumption of the White House Conference on Children and Youth, is declared passed.
Can I make a recommendation?
Since please. This is,
Speaker Roblin's office. I don't think these can't be. I don't think these can't be useless. I think we should be encouraged if we're bringing these forward that they go lobby our federal delegation afterwards after this body moves them out, and they do the work on the other side to make sure they're heard.
Sounds like a voluntary to carry the memorial.
And Representative Parrish.
Yeah,
I was going to say the same thing. Shall we? shall I talk to Speaker Roblin and see if he'd like to carry that memorial?
If he would, I think he should.
And that's what I
and
the record
should encourage him to go to our federal delegation and ask them to make this happen, right? So
I will take both messages to the chair, Roblin, Representative Harker.
We do have co-speakers.
But our delegation is a lobby.
Oh, my gosh. When did this happen? Okay.
So I missed something.
I should send the information to both. I will do so.
Don't
want to leave him out. Now, that so 12 is done, and I'd like to close the work session on House Joint Memorial 12 and continue with our work session on House Joint Memorial 13, which, as we all know, urges Congress to pass the Social Work Reinvestment Act. Is there any discussion?
Both are open.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
Do you mind your own business?
That is my business.
Here. Children.
I'm kidding. I need all your help. So.
Chair.
Yes. Representative Widener.
Is this kind of urging Congress to, like, price fix?
No, it's not, but thanks for asking. The chair would.
Would you like a motion?
Entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the. Oh, wait a minute. Am I the right one? Yeah, adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/111 on HJM 13.
Chair Tomei has moved to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/111 to House Joint Memorial 13. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move HJM 13 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Chair Tomei moves that House Joint Memorial 13 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Wyder. Aye.
Representative
Harper.
Aye.
Representative
Greenman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Aye. Aye. The amended memorial is adopted. And Representative Tomei has agreed to carry the memorial on the floor. And with that, I close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 13. And I hereby adjourn the committee on the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you all.